This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Despite the mass shooting in Dallas, Texas late last week, in which 5 police officers were killed, thousands of activists with Black Lives Matter protested in cities over the weekend. Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where Alton Sterling was killed in a horrific videotaped incident by the police, was a site of mass actions, as were cities like St. Paul, Minnesota, where Philando Castile's life ended at the hands of police. Other cities, including Atlanta, Georgia, Memphis, Tennessee, Cincinnati, Ohio, and Inglewood, California, joined the tide of activism, even shutting down streets and risking arrest. Meanwhile, President Obama is expected to attend a memorial service on Tuesday in Dallas for the 5 slain officers, cutting short his trip to Europe. He'll be speaking at the event alongside former President George W. Bush. Vice President Joe Biden and former First Lady Laura Bush will also be in attendance. My guest is Chenjerai Kumanyika. He is an assistant professor of communication studies at Clemson University in South Carolina and a correspondent for Rising Up with Sonali. Welcome to the program, Chenjerai.
Thank you for having me.
So it feels like we are at a very important moment, 3 years after the Black Lives Matter hashtag was first kind of, you know, pronounced, and 2 years almost since the Ferguson uprising. Do you feel, or rather 1 year after the Ferguson uprising, do you feel that this situation that we are in right now is a crucial moment in U.S. history as the nation tackles the relations between police and the community?
Well, I think moments where you have this much attention on this problem and this many people who have a sense that there's something that needs to be changed, and I think a sense of that deep systemic change is needed, not simply surface police training. You know, those kind of moments are really important, even though the problem of police extrajudicial killing and brutality is ongoing.
Let's talk about what has happened so far. We know in terms of what happened in Dallas, Texas, that a young African-American man was the mass shooter, as far as we can tell, who succeeded in killing 5 police officers. There's testimony that he made rambling statements, that he might have been struggling with some sort of mental illness. But we also know that he was killed by a robot bomb that the Dallas police decided to deploy. What are your thoughts on how this scenario played out?
Yes, well, you know, of course, the police department has claimed that he had already, this person who I guess was a suspect, I'm not sure if that's a word that's meaningful anymore, but I guess it was a suspect in the shooting, was already endangering police officers, and they had negotiated with him, and after hours of negotiation, they were forced to use this robot drone, basically. And so I think that, you know, the question is, what kind of ethical issues are raised by a problem like this? And I think that one of the things is it raises issues that are similar, you know, in the context of Obama's ongoing drone program, which is how do people, you know, what is the process that we're going to use to determine who gets put on a kill list and is allowed to be killed? I mean, as a result of this person being killed, we're unable to get more information from them, even about the plan. Initially, there was a claim that there were multiple shooters and that there may have been more people involved, and now you can't ask this person that, which actually seems like it could endanger more people. So this the idea of killing someone, and we also don't know, you know, we also don't know much about this suspect, really. But what we do know is that the Dallas Police Department initially identified a wrong person as a suspect and invited people to help them find that person.
Right. They, in fact, tweeted an image of a man, a black man, who was walking around in the, you know, open carry state of Texas with an assault rifle. Presumably, he was licensed to use it. He was wearing a shirt that had fatigues on it. And they just tweeted this out. This is one of our suspects. Please help us find him. And it turns out the guy turned himself in. Because he was considered a suspect, was totally not involved in any of the things that played out, but the police kept that image up. And we have the image up, but we decided to blur his face to not add any more to the, the horrors that he has had to face, because apparently the guy started getting death threats right away, and this was a pretty irresponsible act. And it seems like you can only kind of use the open carry law in Texas if you're white, and if you're an armed black person, you're immediately a suspect.
From what I understand, days after, because they chose to leave this image, his image on Twitter, he was approached by a group of white supremacist folks who hadn't apparently got the memo that he was not a suspect. And so it just goes to show how that's this process is dangerous. And, we'd also have to raise the question, what if they had used this robot drone on him? So I guess, I'm not suggesting that, somehow we shouldn't treat a person who is killing people seriously. But this drone situation definitely raises ethical questions.
Right. And apparently the decision was made to deploy this drone robot with a bomb because the police didn't want to risk any more of their lives to take this to arrest Micah Johnson, the person that they decided and accused of killing. And it's likely that he was a killer. I mean, we weren't there. We don't really know exactly how things played out. But apparently he was in a place where, because he was armed, had they approached him to arrest him, he would have been able to shoot them, so they made this decision. But I understand, as far as I know, that he wasn't really holding any hostages. But, in the throes of these situations, things happen, and then you have to kind of disentangle in the aftermath how everything played out. However, Chenjerai, people don't waste much time in trying to look into the minds of suspected murderers through their Facebook pages. So already a narrative emerged very quickly about who Micah Johnson was. Images were flashed of him wearing a dashiki and a fist in the air, that he was allied with black militant groups. And this attempt was made to paint him as a member of Black Lives Matter who wanted to kill some cops because Black Lives Matter are critical of cops. What do you make of this?
Yeah, well, it was very interesting how the police department picked certain images and built their narrative about Micah Xavier Johnson based on certain images and not others. So, what they talked about was that he had the black power fist raised. They used the phrase, we're unsure if he was part of a black nationalist group. But as far as I know, there was no evidence of him being a part of a group. Just because he had these symbols that people associate with black nationalism. What we know for sure is that he was a private first class in the U.S. Army Reserve, and he was deployed to Afghanistan between November 2013 to July 2014, where he earned service medals. So that's for sure, but initially the images that we saw circulating were not of him in his military gear. So that was interesting.
Now, I'm wondering whether you, let's talk about how officials have responded to this. One of the people who was brought in to comment on the weekend's activities was former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, under whose regime the New York Police Department developed many of their unethical tactics. Rudy Giuliani made some kind of shocking comments on CBS's Face the Nation. Among them, he said, when you say Black Lives Matter, that's inherently racist. He said, white lives matter, black lives matter, Asian lives matter, Hispanic lives matter. That's anti-American and it's racist. When there are 60 shootings in Chicago over the 4th of July and 14 murders and Black Lives Matter is non-existent, then there's one police murder of very questionable circumstances and we hear from Black Lives Matter. We wonder, do black lives matter, or only the very few black lives that are killed by white policemen? He said a few other things too, but let's tackle this one first, Chenjerai. This is the familiar and tired excuse that we hear often from white supremacists saying black-on-black crime is the real issue, not police violence.
Absolutely. And, as you said, this trope is familiar. What the idea is to do is to take the well-known fact that most often interpersonal violence happens between people within communities, often with geographic proximity. So white people are more likely to kill white people. I think I've seen statistics that say there's like 89% of killings of white people are by other white people. And a similar number is the case with black on black crime. But in the case of so-called black, what is called black on black crime, but what I call interpersonal violence, it is used to try to paint black people as somehow pathologically more oriented to kill each other. And, to say white on white crime almost seems silly. but yet the term black on black crime is allowed to circulate. So that's one thing. There's more to say about Giuliani's comments for sure.
And this All Lives Matter aspect is yet another kind of ignorant statement that is, you know, refusing to accept the fact that black people are disproportionately killed by police, and that it's precisely because black lives have not mattered to police that people are saying black lives matter, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, one thing I want to say about Giuliani is, you know, one thing that hasn't been talked enough about in this whole debate about police departments are pretty much trying to characterize themselves as in a slow process of trying to regain trust with the community and root out the bad apples. But one thing that goes strongly against that narrative is the police unions in places both like in Baltimore, where they sent out very egregious tweets just celebrating the exoneration of certain officers in the Freddie Gray case, and in New York, where New York Police Union runs a magazine called Police Mag, which has all manner of very offensive things that seem extremely backward. And, you know, they did things like turn their backs on de Blasio when he had tried to make more balanced comments. So Giuliani's comments are right in line with this more reactionary view that is deeply institutionalized in the NYPD and goes against the idea that police are learning anything based on what's happened in the past 2 years.
He went on to make even more egregious comments, basically lecturing the black community. Giuliani said on CBS's Face the Nation, "If I were a black father and I was concerned with the safety of my child, really concerned about it and not in a politically activist sense," that right there, by the way, is him questioning whether black parents care about their children. He said, "I would say be very respectful of the police. Most of them are good. Some can be very bad, and just be very careful. I'd also say be very careful of those kids in the neighborhood and don't get involved with them, because, son, there's a 99% chance they're going to kill you, not the police. And we've got to hear from the black community," Giuliani said. "We've got to hear from the black communities how they're doing among themselves about the crime problem in the black community." Where does he get the statistic, 99%?
I don't know where he gets that. That doesn't sound like it's any research I've seen that statistic makes sense. But what I would say is that at this moment, it's crucial that if people in law enforcement are trying to get to a new place of trust, that they have to reflect some understanding of what's going on, and that the public at large gets to a deeper conversation. And Giuliani's comments reveal both not just the deep cultural problems of racism in police departments, but what are also the deep structural problems, because those biases get encoded into laws like stop and frisk, and they also invite us to look back at the origins of police departments, which really have never, in the history of the United States, prioritized the importance of black or brown lives, or shown any deep concern for those lives. And so Giuliani's comments are not, I think we have to be careful. We don't want to paint them as a perversion or as something different, but rather deeply in line with the institutional, structural, and cultural priorities of policing in the United States.
And even the priorities of our society when it comes to policing, that we do prioritize police over everybody else. I want to quote President Obama, who during his trip to Europe while he was in Spain, and was asked to comment on what's unfolding in the U.S., said, "Whenever those of us who are concerned about fairness in the criminal justice system attack police officers, you're doing a disservice to the cause." Chandra, I was really shocked by this comment. He's implying, let me repeat it, "Whenever those of us who are concerned about fairness in the criminal justice system attack police officers, you're doing a disservice to the cause." Is he actually implying that Black Lives Matter caused the killing of these police officers in Dallas, which sounds like what he's implying?
Right. I mean, I don't know what cause is he talking about.
What does he mean by attack police officers? Does he mean criticize them when they kill people?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. And this prioritizing of blue lives, I mean, this has a long history too. Even if you go to policing and its history in the UK, There was a process of trying to use a certain amount of prestige around policing as a mechanism of control. But in this environment, where people are deeply suspicious, where you have a huge rift in the country and people are deeply suspicious that police think that their lives matter more, and that that's the dominant priorities in the country, you would think that there would be an effort to try to say that no, police lives matter. Police lives don't matter more than other lives. But what you get instead is public, collective, political statements by police. You know, and I understand. In one sense, one can understand groups of human beings trying to rally around and support each other. But when you see such a stark comparison between the inability of police to form as a collective public political unit and denounce the most egregious aspects of their practice, and yet when what they call one of their own does it, and even in that language, one of our own, revealing that they don't feel that the average citizen or you know, that might be African American, is one of their own, right? There's this ability for them to come together and be collective and political about it.
Let's talk about how, despite all of this, Black Lives Matter and those activists who claim allegiance to that statement were not cowed over the weekend. We saw huge protests in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, St. Paul, Minnesota, the two cities where the two latest and most high-profile killings of African Americans have happened, and also places like Inglewood, California, here in Southern California, where our program is based. I was so proud to see apparently something like 1,000 or 2,000 people showing up, blocking the 405 freeway, Memphis, Tennessee, Cincinnati, Ohio, all cities where Black people have been killed by police officers, and there's been zero accountability of those police officers. How important was this showing?
Well, I think that I just want to clarify, you're talking about the protests in around the country?
Yeah, and the ones that actually happened after the Dallas killings of police.
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen protests in New Orleans, in St. Paul, Atlanta, huge protests in Atlanta, Georgia, New York, Memphis, Chicago, Oklahoma, and near me in Greenville, South Carolina, where we had five protesters were arrested, and ongoing. I mean, in St. Paul, I think they've protested each night consistently every night since the Philando Castile murder. I think that the rapid succession of these killings and something about these particular tapes, the way that they were captured, really reveals the horror of this and has made people feel unsafe, and I think has brought people to a sense that something deeper is needed. The conversation in certain communities and activist communities is proceeding beyond anything to do with body cams and police training, and moving into a deep reflection on the function of policing in this country.
And there was this photo that emerged, I believe, from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, of a young woman calmly standing. She's wearing a long flowing dress, a young Black woman standing. She looks like she's almost meditating. And these two police officers, so heavily armed, I mean, they look like they're robots from some futuristic movie. They're wearing so much padding. They're dressed in all black. They've got, glass in front of their eyes. And they're approaching her, and they're totally off balance. And she's completely in balance. And a lot of people have been pointing to this image as kind of capturing the dynamic between Black Lives Matter and police officers. What do you make of this photo?
Well, they say a picture is worth 1,000 words. And I mean, when you talk about the militarization of the police and the sort of, consistent and but also absurd arming of police and the shift of police from any kind of pretense that they're serving the community to one in which they're clearly occupying the community, this photo captures all of that. And I think that it also captures, by the way, that process of militarization being one that is explicitly advocated in the pages of NYPD's Police Mag every day. But when you look at this woman, what I think this picture also captures is the way in which Black women and women of color have really stood up and been an ongoing force in this movement. I mean, and that would have to include the incredible collectedness of Diamond Reynolds, who even in the midst of this tragedy was able to collect herself and produce a video that not only helped her get accountability, but will hopefully ultimately move the movement forward.
This is Philando Castile's girlfriend who was in the car, in fact, driving the car, when she and her boyfriend were pulled over with her child in the background. And I'm so glad you brought that up. I mean, I'm just continually stunned by her courage that, would any of us think to have that level of presence of mind in a situation when a cop has just basically shot your loved one, and you think to start a Facebook Live video as your only weapon against cops and as your only sort of tool for accountability. That is pretty remarkable. And had it not been for that video, Philando Castile's name might not have been as well known as it is now. And I'm wondering what you think this is going to come out of this moment, Chenjerai, now that we are here. Black Lives Matter isn't going anywhere, but the police are digging their heels in. Politicians seem to be casting their lots with the police. They seem to be claiming Blue Lives Matter more than anybody else's. And it seems as though it's this very, very powerful but very frightening polarization that something needs to give. The question is, what will give?
Yes, it's really interesting to see what will happen. I have to say, when we look at the fact that in the places where there's been, you know, the strongest response in Ferguson, in New York, and in Baltimore, where there was an uprising there, we also have not seen really the kind of, you know, any real legal accountability for, you know, the people that are slain by police officers. And that has the risk of being deeply demoralized. And so the threat of demoralization is certainly there. But I think when it comes to police, you know, I've been talking about the fact that there's a need to look more deeply. What I'm hearing people talk about, you know, for example, there was a BET special in which, you know, activists and community members were coming together and people were talking about defunding, demilitarizing and disarming the police. Now, you know, that's on BET, which is basically a place for corporate propaganda that just sells black people to corporations and pretends to care about us. But even in that venue, they were talking about defunding, disarming, and demilitarizing the police. So I think that, you know, those issues, the issues of community oversight, you know, representation, militarization, and then getting into police union contracts, I think is really an important component of this. All those deeper elements, deeper structural things, are things that people are reflecting on, but I think it's also prompted a deeper reflection on really the place of people of color in the United States of America and what this really means.
Hmm. And finally, Chenjerai, it just kind of is astounding that the simple resistance to black people being getting killed in the streets by police has invoked such a defensive reaction from those people who've been blind to the historic and continued and never relenting police violence against black people. That this idea that Black Lives Matter is, you know, it just inspires so much defensiveness that implies people are just supposed to sit back and let themselves be killed. We're supposed to not ask for accountability. We're supposed to not demand police be charged, convicted, and sentenced to prison. We're supposed to simply shut up and deal with the police violence because black on black crime, because et cetera, you know, and whatever reasons are thrown out there, that this idea that black lives do matter as much as everyone else's is offensive to some people. And that's just mind blowing.
No, it really is. And I mean, I think it's you see it, any real effort to highlight this for people to defend themselves, to speak out about it is basically cast as divisive. I had an incredible sort of anecdotal situation where my sister, a sister-in-law, shared the video of Philando Castile's situation, and a person came on her, a commenter said, "It's divisive for you to share this video, and you should stop sharing it because it divides the races and it makes people not like police." And, you know, you just have to wonder, how is that person thinking about the fact that, you know, Diamond Reynolds shared that video to get accountability in the situation, to protect herself actually in the moment? I mean, there's no consideration of that. What's to be its consideration is white people's feelings and police feelings over the value of black lives. It's really amazing.
Well, Chenjerai, I want to thank you so much, as always, for joining us today. And I'm sure we'll have you back on in the future again. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Salami.
Chenjerai Komanyika is an assistant professor of communication studies at Clemson University in South Carolina and a correspondent for Rising Up with Sonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.